Welcome to The Record here on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The University of Washington wants to cure the world. Sounds ambitious, but that's the idea behind the new Population Health Initiative. And they just got some help this week from the Gates Foundation, who just donated $210 million toward a new building. One of this project's planners, Professor Thaisa Way, says the Population Health Initiative will tackle big issues: health, well-being, the environment.
Because the environment impacts our own health in amazing and deep ways. So it's going to be a healthier environment, and then there's going to be more social and economic justice, because that's an integral part of well-being. And in the end, it's also an integral part of our human health. It so often depends on the resources that we have access to. So what population health does is it brings people that look at all three of those issues, which, quite frankly, is called a university. And we come together and we think about, how do we make sure that when kids go to school, they are not suffering from the stress of racism or suffering from the illness of asthma, all because of the environment they live in or the social inequities that they live in, which then get manifested as ill health or a lack of ideal health. So if we can come together and figure those problems out together, we will literally improve the health of the world, and it will improve the health of the planet, and it will improve issues of equity. That's why I think this is an audacious initiative, because that is a big, big picture look at how we can truly have impact on the world, in addition to all the little tiny sort of almost acupuncture ways that we each contribute.
Yeah, what a big picture. Social economic justice, well-being, environment, curing disease. You're a landscape architecture professor. What are you doing running this Population Health Initiative?
Well, I'm saying I'm not running it, just participating, helping get it going. And I'm in that role, I think, for two reasons. Maybe even three. But one is, coming from landscape architecture and the design profession, we believe deeply that your environment, and that's your social context and your literally the planet, the landscape, the city around you, have an impact on population health, right? So whether you take stairs matters a lot in your health, and whether you make that choice matters whether stairs are easily accessible. Or if you have different able people, what access they have to the kinds of movement that they need will help determine their own health. And that's all about design. So that's a designer in me. When I'm sitting here looking out over Washington Square, and the role of parks and cities has become increasingly clear, it is directly related to people's health and well-being, and of course environmental well-being. And social equity issues are involved in park design, because where those parks are and what amenities they make accessible to different communities also impacts their health. So that's the design part of me. The other part that I'm involved in is I'm really part of a larger movement of a lot of faculty, and I direct a program called Urban at UW, and it does the same thing, which we are reimagining the university as, rather than just disciplines, that we come together around the really big questions. How do we come together across the university to all contribute our piece of the pie, as it were, to have a larger impact?
I want to underline that, Professor. Rethinking the University of Washington, forming around challenges instead of dividing up into disciplines. How radical is that among American universities? And is this going to spread through the whole UW?
I'll answer you backwards, because it's pretty exciting. So the Population Health Initiative will indeed spread to the whole university. And that is pretty amazing. And in our initial inventory, just to see who, like, really obviously fit in, there are people from every single college, all three campuses. So the answer to you is yes, in some way all of us can be involved, depending on our own personal interests. And the second thing is, yeah, this is really radical for universities, because universities have built around the ideas of colleges and schools that have disciplinary focus. And those are an important core of what we build on. And what I would suggest is we have the ability to now build on top of that and say, okay, now that we've got these incredible foundational cores, how do we bring them together? How do we fill in the gaps, find the synergies between them, and build greater impact? And you can only do that, right, when you have fantastic building blocks. But now we have an opportunity to do something above and beyond. And I do think it's going to spread to other universities. And I see other universities doing this in bits and pieces. But no one, as far as I know, has actually had the audacity to really take on the initiative and say, all right, this is really going to go across the whole university, and we're going to open the door for everyone to participate. And we're going to find new and innovative ways to get you to the table, which means, you know, getting the climate scientists to sit down with the faculty in social work, you know, next to the faculty in painting, next to the faculty in geography as an idea, and sit down and start to talk and think about how their work intersects and how their work builds on each other.
Professor, I usually figure if there's no resistance to something, it's not that big a change. How much resistance is there?
You know, what's exciting about this initiative is, and I would absolutely agree, I always take the claim, if nobody's mad at me, then I'm not making any difference.
There you go.
Right? So I would argue there is a huge amount of excitement, right, because people love a big, grand vision. And there's a lot of people who've been coming to the university in hopes of making a greater impact. On the other hand, is there skepticism about whether we can really get humanists and artists and scientists all sitting down and lawyers all at the same table? Yeah, there's a lot of skepticism. Are there a lot of language barriers? You know, when a lawyer talks to me, there are times when my eyes glaze over because I'm not sure what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to work over those barriers, and that's where those innovative methods are going to have to come in. That's an unknown, and it's going to take the faculty who are willing to put some blood, sweat, and tears into this work to make it work. So, yeah, there's skepticism. There's pushback. There are concerns about how are we going to measure this? How do you measure something that's this big? But I'd argue that most of that is matched by those people who are excited and respond with, yeah, exactly. If I knew what I was doing, then I'm probably not doing anything new. If I want to have real impact, I probably have to be out of my comfort zone and doing things that I'm not sure are going to succeed. And there's, again, think about Seattle and think about the University of Washington. That's part of our ethos, right? We collaborate a lot and we're willing to take those risks. So I think we'll make some probably spectacular failures. But I hope we'll make some more spectacular successes.
Some more spectacular successes. That's Thaisa Way, University of Washington Professor of Landscape Architecture, talking about the start of a 25-year public health project, the Population Health Initiative. Their new building will go somewhere on the U District campus, and the Gates Foundation just donated $210 million to build it. Now we're going to talk about money being donated to our political system. When the Supreme Court made its Citizens United decision, the court ruled that political spending by corporations and unions is protected free speech. Well, now there's a Washington State initiative calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. KUOW's David Hyde says amending the Constitution is not easy, and not everyone thinks it's the right idea.
Linda Brewster lives in Port Townsend, but today she's made the trip all the way into Seattle to make some phone calls.
Hi, is Kimberly there, please? Well, this is Linda. I'm a volunteer with Initiative 735.
Brewster estimates she's dedicated over 1,500 hours of her life to this campaign because she believes there's a fundamental problem in American politics, money.
I'm really tired of seeing so many issues that people care passionately about. Environmental changes, action on climate change, public health issues, that the people's opinion seems to have absolutely nothing to do with what our legislators end up deciding to do.
Nina Turner agrees.
Let's be honest. We have rich people competing against each other to become the president of the United States of America. That's what is happening.
Turner's a former state senator from Ohio, a college professor, a Bernie Sanders Democrat, and a frequent cable TV show commentator.
And it's not just on the presidential level. If you look at governor's races, any type of statewide elections now, millions and millions of dollars. Look at how much it costs to run a U.S. Senate race, for God's sakes. Millions and millions and millions of dollars.
And Turner says Initiative 735 goes after the right target to fix all that. The United States Supreme Court decision from back in 2010 called Citizens United.
This is so important because with Citizens United, money is speech, and now money is overpowering our political process. It always has been, but I think Citizens United just really put it front and center.
Citizens United basically said corporations and labor unions have the same free speech rights as individuals. So now they can spend as much money as they like to persuade people how to vote as long as the money is not spent directly on campaigns. Initiative 735 asks our congressional representatives to back a constitutional amendment to reject that decision. The idea is to bring back limits on independent political spending. And it's not just for corporations. It also wants limits on spending by groups like the Sierra Club, the NRA, Planned Parenthood, as well as corporations and unions, because, as Turner puts it,
money is not speech.
At least that's what initiative backers think. Opponents like Paul Guppy disagree. He's with the Washington Policy Center, a think tank here that promotes free market solutions. And Guppy starts by admitting that Initiative 735 backers kind of have a point.
That is definitely correct, that there are corporations, there are influential individuals, there are nonprofit groups that raise a lot of money, there are super PACs, and they have a big influence. So I would agree with them 100% that they are right about what they see happening in our political system. Where we would disagree, I think, is what to do about it.
Guppy says 735 is the wrong solution.
Giving more power to the government to restrict our speech, which is what Initiative 735 is trying to move towards, is not something that I would agree with. The antidote to speech you don't agree with is more speech.
Okay, more speech. But what exactly does that mean?
More of a competition in the marketplace of ideas, joining together with others to raise money and combat, you know, big corporations or whatever message that you're hearing that you don't agree with to put out an alternative message.
So that's the debate. Let's say Initiative 735 passes. What happens after that? Short term, basically nothing. The initiative just asks our delegation to support a constitutional amendment. And that would take a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate and the House, and the amendment would then have to be ratified by three-quarters of the states, only 17 of which have signed up so far. Even backers admit it's a long shot. So why spend so much time and effort on it? Nina Turner says because money in politics is such a big problem that you have to start somewhere. And she makes the point that amending the Constitution's always been hard, whether it was ending slavery or getting women the right to vote.
I'm sure people told them the same thing. You dreaming. This is hard. This will never happen, but it happened.
In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Initiative 735 is on your ballot if you're registered to vote. If you're not registered, there's still time to do that in person. The deadline is Halloween. We're going to take a look at the presidential election and all its ripples. Last night, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich tried to lecture Fox News' Megyn Kelly on her fascination with sex and scandal. And you'll hear about that today on this afternoon's All Things Considered here on KUOW. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The number of women telling their stories of sexual harassment and assault keeps growing. And you can add to that list the former First Lady of Washington State. Mona Lee Locke is a communications professional. She was married to Washington's Governor Gary Locke. She posted her stories of sexual harassment on Facebook after listening to Donald Trump call his accusers liars.
When I saw him kind of bullying them and in a way re-victimizing the victims, I found myself like in my head, you know, talking about this and going, you know, you have to stop and this is not the way you treat these people. And then I thought it was a process of thinking, you know what, I need to write this down so it gets out of my head and I can let go of it, because I couldn't let go. It was eating away at me. So I started writing just stream of consciousness, and that's essentially the next day I thought, I have to post this.
Wasn't political for you?
Yes and no, because it was political because I was in disbelief that someone who could say these things publicly could actually be a nominee for office of the president. That to me was incredible, and that's kind of what prompted it. If it was a Republican or Democrat, if this is the way someone speaks about women, I would be speaking out.
You know, Mona, one of the things that was so striking about what you wrote was the number of stories you had, the amount of harassment that you had faced. And that's still news to some of us, you know, that this is that big a problem.
And I don't think it's just a problem for me. I mean, what became clear and what was surprising to me was just how widespread the post was shared. I mean, it was, you know, liked some 3,000 times or so. But to me, what was more amazing was that it was shared over 1,600 times. What prompted me to come on this radio show, because I had said no to all the media, because I had kind of said my piece and I had put down my thoughts and my feelings and my experience. But what really prompted me was the fact that there were all these other stories out there. I just felt like I had to speak for them, because for them, what became clear was all these people have not talked about it. I mean, there was a story with a mom who messaged me and said that it was the 1970s. She was in labor, and a young doctor came in and fondled her breasts while she was in labor. And she was so appalled and so embarrassed that she never said anything. All these years, and one of your most amazing experiences, childbirth, and she was fondled, never told anyone. So when my piece came out, I guess she forwarded it to her two daughters, and they proceeded to have a discussion after that, and she told her story for the first time. And for the first time, both her daughters came forth with their own stories of sexual harassment, right? Stories like that. I had a gentleman who actually I serve on a board with. He came up to me and he said, you know, I need to talk to you. I got to say, I'm a Republican. He goes, but I want you to know that your piece struck home with me. I read it and I felt ashamed. He said, I have failed my daughter. He goes, she was a young professional in Bellevue, came to me several times and said, Dad, you know, these guys are harassing me, or they're asking me out in lewd ways or whatever, right? And he goes, and I kind of like said, honey, deal with it. That's just life. And he read that piece and he came back and he made it a point to say, you know what? I have failed her and I forwarded your piece to her and I said, can we talk? Stories like that, you know, you realize how prevalent it is in society. I mean, I was just telling my story, and yeah, it happened to me in many different ways and throughout my career.
And you had said that at least sometimes you weren't sure, is this for real? That's how you put it in your Facebook post. Is this happening?
Well, you think, is it for real? And then you think, maybe I'm being overly dramatic and it's not a big deal, right? I mean, I grew up with two brothers. I hung out with guys, high school, college. But now when I think back too, it's like, you know, I was kind of around guys and I actually heard a lot of that stuff. And I think probably for me subliminally, I just didn't want to be one of them on the other side of it, right?
Yeah, in that group that they were treating that way?
Yeah, and then I was anyway.
What made you decide, oh yes, that was real? You know, I wasn't imagining, I wasn't exaggerating that or misunderstanding.
I really couldn't be the judge of that. All I could do was talk about my experiences and how it impacted me so deeply. And, you know, for me, it was therapy. It was just finally putting out there how I was feeling and the impact it was having on me. As so many other victims, I think, of sexual harassment, right? I think when you see it out there, and now that I've kind of come to deal with it head on, I think you're re-victimized each time when someone calls you a liar or says that's not true. I mean, it's my experience, and I'm the only one that went through it. All I can do is share it and hope that it doesn't continue with other women. And I do think it comes down to a cultural shift, how we talk about women, how we think about women. And I think it's also, you know, partly a control thing.
I was surprised when I heard you say that harassment you experienced was to the level where you had to talk to your children about it. Do you want to tell us what you went through?
No, I can't really, but all I can say is I felt that at a certain point, we need to talk about it as a family, as a community, as a culture, and it starts at home. And I felt that I'd gone through some experiences that were very upsetting, and I actually couldn't really keep it from the kids. They could see how upset I was. So I felt the next best step was to really be open with them and talk. And obviously, I have different aged kids, and at that time, it's what's appropriate.
Yeah.
Right. So, but I do think it starts at home. There was one woman that messaged me and told me about a story where she went to Taekwondo with her son, and she saw this little boy grab a girl's butt, like one of the little girls, and the mother of the girl came in, stepped in, and said, no, you can't do that. And the boy waited a couple minutes, did it again, So this woman went over and started talking to the little boy and saying, you know what, that is inappropriate. And so the Taekwondo instructor came over and said, you know, what's going on? What are you talking about? And she explained it to the instructor. And the instructor said, well, yes, he shouldn't have grabbed her, but the girl needs to stand up for herself. And that's kind of the attitude so often, I think, that happens in sexual harassment. It's like what I was told at one job, too, was, well, maybe if you had not let him grab you or had asked him to move his hand, maybe it wouldn't have happened again. And so you're the one to blame, in essence, right? Because you're being told, well, if you had stopped that behavior, it wouldn't have happened again. Versus the whole thought that it shouldn't have happened in the first place.
So you did try to tell somebody about this?
No, you know what? I didn't. That was the problem. Because when you're in the moment and you're the victim, it's at that moment that you're thinking, this isn't really happening or what's going on. And so you're caught so off guard that I didn't do anything. After the fact, I was told by superiors, well, maybe had you just done something, it wouldn't have repeated. And so I think part of it, someone had texted me and really talked about the fact that not only do we need to teach boys respect, but girls self-respect, right? It happens on both ends. Girls need to say, no, this is not right. You can't do that. But it really shouldn't happen in the first place.
Everybody is asking in a lot of ways what happens post Donald Trump's candidacy. What do you think is happening now? Is this just a publicity blip, people telling these stories, or do you see signs of a permanent change?
I don't think it's a blip. I think it is people actually feeling courage to stand up and talk about their stories. I think this has gone on for so long. And how many countless women have told me their stories, and really a lot of people messenger me so they're not public. And they say, I can't because I feel like my career is on the line. Same thing with me. When it happened, I thought, I've worked so hard for this career. I can't be branded this because I will never be able to get another job in this career. I mean, as I said in my story, I consulted with an attorney and he said, look, in the bigger scheme of things, looking out for you, don't even talk about it. He goes, don't even tell HR about it. That was the advice I was given to protect me. Because then it becomes he said, she said in the long run, right?
Yeah.
And chances are, if it's someone who's superior to you, you're going to get tossed out eventually.
What has sharing your story and reading all those other stories done for you? How has that affected you?
It has impacted me tremendously, more than I thought it would. I think it has been an emotional couple of weeks because you're vulnerable when you open up and you talk about your own experiences. And I think I was so touched by the outpouring of support and words of encouragement from people. But then to read about all these other stories was really hard for me to know that other people have gone through this. It's not that I wouldn't imagine that, but to actually read these stories and understand that my post had that kind of impact, that it could inspire people to actually come forth and empower themselves by telling their stories, right? It's like the silence that has lived on forever. And I think I thank Trump for actually bringing light to the subject. I hope that the conversation continues and that this actually, he was a catalyst for something good, for opening the doors for people to feel comfortable, more comfortable speaking up. You know, no one wants to feel like a victim. It was horrifying to see in media, you know, I'm not going to be victimized anymore. I'm thinking, did I say that? Because we don't want to feel like victims. We just wanted to be treated equally and with respect.
Mona Leelock, thanks for posting that on Facebook and giving other women and men a voice in talking with us.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. And I just really want to thank all the people out there who have been supportive in speaking out on this issue. Like I said, it takes all of us really being open about it and having a conversation to have anything change.
Mona Lee Locke, former First Lady of Washington State, now a communications professional. After seeing the response to her online post, she created a new Facebook page called We Stand Together. There you will see other people's stories, and you'll see a conversation about what needs to change. We will tweet out a link to that Facebook page now, at KUOW. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Are you voting yes or no on the new Sound Transit project of light rail and buses? There are people donating to both sides of the campaign trying to shape your opinion. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols spoke with some of the donors and found a big disagreement over which is better, light rail or vanpools.
So I'm with this guy, Chuck Collins, and he walks me to the end of his driveway on West Mercer Way because he wants to show me something. And he points to a bus stop sign on the other side of the road.
All right.
It's slowly being eaten by blackberry bushes.
It looks neglected, I would say. I used to catch that bus when I was running Metro Transit. The bus came right down West Mercer Way, collected a good load of passengers, and took us to downtown Seattle where I worked.
Collins ran Metro in the late 70s, so it might surprise you that he's against light rail. But until a few weeks ago, his $1,000 contribution made him the top donor fighting ST3. Recently, much bigger donors have surpassed him, but Collins signed on to fight ST3 early. He says that bus stop over there, emerging from the blackberry bushes, helps explain why.
When that sign falls down, there will be no one complaining.
Collins says that's because years ago, the bus route at that stop changed. It became a feeder line. Instead of taking people directly to downtown Seattle, it made people transfer at the park and ride in downtown Mercer Island. Collins says Sound Transit's trains would do the same thing. Much of our region won't be within walking distance of light rail, even after all of ST3 is built. So people living and working in decentralized areas will have to transfer a lot. Many people will take buses from their homes to the trains, and then they'll take buses from the trains to their work.
There's nothing mysterious here. We've known these principles about people hating transfers for years. We know that. Now, in Paris, given the way the system worked, people will transfer. They don't transfer in Seattle, and they don't transfer in most West Coast cities.
Transfers have become easier for riders over the years since Collins ran Metro, especially with electronic Orca cards. But Collins says, just look at his neighbors.
They take cars.
They drive rather than bus. Why not make it easier for them to take transit, rather than forcing people into a system that requires transfers to get from home to work? And then he asked me, why not invest in vanpools?
The paradigm I like to think about is a radically different system. Radically different, in which self-driving vans are the dominant form of mass transit.
As an example of where our future might be heading, Collins points to Microsoft's Connector service. Vans and small buses pick people up where they live and take them directly to work. But I wanted to push on that idea a little bit and see how it might work in practice. So I hitched a ride on a Microsoft Connector bus.
Yes, I got 3 on board from the Commons. I'm taking to 34. Come on, guys. Oh, this guy's killing me with that microphone.
Gieta Hayes has been driving for Microsoft for 9 years. Before that, she was a cook at Microsoft. I asked her if her Connector bus gets stuck in traffic very often.
Of course we do.
Like when she's driving on Highway 520, and she comes to the exit for Microsoft. People start lining up way before they get to the exit. And then they just inch along, bumper to bumper, in the HOV lane of all places.
It sucks, okay? I'm not gonna lie. Okay, maybe I shouldn't be telling him all this, huh?
The problem with buses, the problem with vanpools, all of those things, is that they sit in traffic. It's extremely unproductive time.
That's Irene Plenifish from Microsoft. She works in government affairs there. She helped the company reach its decision to pour $300,000 into the campaign to approve Sound Transit 3. She says Microsoft needs ST3. Microsoft Connector buses can carry over 7,000 workers, but that's just scratching the surface. Almost 40,000 people work at Microsoft in Redmond.
You know, we've implemented a stopgap, if you will, but for us to sort of implement that for every single one of our employees is a little bit unrealistic.
With congestion getting worse, you could argue the Connector bus is just becoming less and less functional over time. In contrast,
light rail has its own right-of-way, and that's how it gets out of the congestion, and that's why we think it's such an important option to develop.
Chuck Collins, on the no side, says we could do more to make van pools viable, like give them more dedicated lanes, you know, just lay down some paint. But taking lanes away from cars has proven politically difficult lately on Interstate 405. Chuck Collins' $1,000 contribution to the no side might seem tiny compared to Microsoft's donation. Companies like Amazon, Costco, and labor unions, too, have also given large donations to the Yes campaign. But recently, the fight became a little more even when Bellevue developer Kemper Freeman and groups he's affiliated with put in $500,000 to stop ST3. In Redmond, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
At KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. When Seattle police officers get off duty, a lot of them go to another job as security guards, oftentimes still dressed in their police uniforms. Is that a conflict of interest, an officer working for a private company? City reporter David Croman at Crosscut told me how this played out for a woman in downtown Seattle.
So she says that she came out of her apartment in downtown on 3rd Avenue, and an honest man that she never met before kind of bumped into her, and when she got huffy, he hit her across the face. And then he kind of turned around, walked away, disappeared into the Ross downtown. And, you know, whether it was wise or not, she decided that she was going to follow him because she was upset and perturbed. And so when she walked into the Ross, she sees the security guard there who's dressed like a cop, has a Seattle Police Department uniform on, and so says, you know, this guy just assaulted me. Can you help? And the guy basically ignored her. And he was indeed actually a Seattle police officer, but at this occasion, he was just working as a security guard at Ross.
And he's not allowed to ignore her because, and I wasn't really sure of this, quote-unquote off-duty police officer is always on duty. He has to act as a Seattle police officer in that moment.
Right. So it's pretty common for Seattle police officers to take second jobs.
Very common.
As security guards, you know, if you go to a baseball game, those cops are all working second jobs.
Yeah, parking garages.
And they're getting their checks paid by, you know, Safeco Field or that parking garage or whatever. But because they're sworn officers, they still have a duty to do everything exactly as they would when they're on duty. The fact that they're working for Ross or whomever doesn't change their sort of code of conduct. And so when this woman came into Ross and said, this man has assaulted me, regardless of what this police officer thought of this woman or whether he believed her or anything, his duty was to look into it, especially since she was saying, the guy came into this store. He's in this store right now. And yet he didn't. He didn't do anything about it. What ended up happening is she was so upset, she was escorted out of the store by the security guard. She went in thinking that she was reporting this crime, and it turned back around on her that she was the one who got kicked out of the store.
And by the way, this police officer had been taken off the streets by the Seattle Police Department.
This police officer had a sort of sordid history. In the early 2000s, he'd actually been arrested for soliciting sex from an undercover officer. He'd also been involved in a few high-profile shootings, not to say they were justified or not, but he'd been there and had fired his gun on a few different occasions. And sort of at last word, he was working a desk job in the West Precinct. And yet when he's employed by Ross, he's essentially patrolling a beat, the Ross beat.
Right. Mixing with the public again.
Right.
So we said this was widespread, you know, sporting events and construction sites and parking garages. Will you talk more about some of the conflicts that that presents?
Yeah, so the issue is if you are working for somebody like Ross, Ross is writing his checks. You know, if you return there day after day, and these officers can work up to 20, 25 hours a week in these second jobs, and you're seeing the person who's writing your checks every day, you're going to start to form a little bit of loyalty to that. And so, you know, in an occasion like Ross, to have the boss sort of come up to you and say, please show this woman the door, which is in direct conflict with what he's supposed to be doing. But knowing at the back of your head that this is the person who writes your checks creates a serious disconnect in who this person is actually serving, whether it's the public, as he or she should be doing, or the store that he works for.
Have you ever wondered whether a police officer working a second job at a parking garage is working for the company, where the private parking garage, letting all those cars out on the street and making the rest of us on the public street back up?
Right. I haven't even needed to wonder that. The Seattle Times a couple of years ago wrote about that exactly happening. They staked out a reporter nearby and observed officers working for private garages. And, you know, some of it was sort of anecdotal, but observed that on a couple of occasions, these officers were clearly letting out more cars from the parking garage than they should be. You know, the light would turn green and yet they'd still stop traffic and let all these cars come out.
So you have some confusion. You have divided loyalties, as we've just said. What is the Seattle Police Department doing about that, if anything?
So right now it's really murky how people find these jobs. A lot of them work for security companies and then go out and get assigned places. But there's not really any system by which they obtain this work. And they do have to get approval from their supervisor, but it's sort of widely believed to just be a rubber stamp. And then that approval is good for a year. So the proposal that's actually on the table right now, and would probably move through about middle of next year, is to create an internal civilian-led office. So not sworn officers, but people who work in the Seattle Police Department, whose job it is to essentially hand out this work. One person I talked to compared it to like a union hiring hall. So you go in, you say, you know, I have my permit, I want to work a second job. And so you have this panel of people who says, great, we have an opening over at Ross, but you're not guaranteed that work over and over. So every time you want some shifts, you have to go to this place. So the idea would be you don't have the opportunity to build the sort of loyalty to an outside employer like you do under this current system.
Yeah, and the employer doesn't know which officer they're going to get.
Right, exactly. And the employer gets whatever officer they're handed. And then also it would sort of create a mechanism by which to reward people who have shown that they can do this work. If somebody has shown that they're not very good at maintaining loyalty to the Seattle public, they might not get as many shifts.
Sounds reasonable. What's the backlash? What's the downside?
Well, the department actually has more recently sort of been clear that this probably should change, that it's an issue. But the question has been, why hasn't it happened earlier? The sort of main civilian watchdog in the city has been writing about this being an issue for many years, since she took this position. So as far back as 2010. And she has argued that because it's secondary employment, officers don't have a, quote, right to this work, which means that overhauling the system wouldn't necessarily need to go through the normal bargaining process with the union. It hasn't happened, and it's really only been pushed forward because of the federal consent decree that the department's under right now.
We're talking with Crosscut reporter David Croman, writing about the blurry line between on-duty Seattle police officer / security guard. And what do you want your reader to take away from all of this, David?
The sort of biggest shame of this is that it's really confusing to the public. If you walk into a store and you see what appears to be a Seattle police officer, they're wearing their uniform, they have a radio on their hip, they have a gun. The public doesn't know who that person is working for right now. So of course you're going to assume they're working as a Seattle police officer. And so if the same standards don't apply to that person at all times, it can be a really confusing occasion. So what I would take away is if you see officers who are working at Safeco Field or parking garage, those officers have to behave exactly as you would expect them to behave in any other situation if they were to come to your house when you called the police. So hold those security guards to the same standard you would any police officer.
This is interesting because if a police officer is always a police officer, even when they're working for someone else, then what about this issue of body cameras? That officer is not wearing a body camera at all times when, you know, he or she is moonlighting or just on a date.
Right. And the people who are more aggressive about defining body camera policy and who really want to see it used as a method for accountability of officers, they're going to argue that if we roll out body cameras, they have to be on those officers at all times. So that would include secondary employment. at Safeco Field, at a parking garage.
Tackling a fan at Safeco Field.
Tackling a fan at Safeco Field. And exactly. I don't think anyone really knows the answer to that. And I think some of these questions are caught up in the same debate around secondary appointment, which is, when is an officer an officer?
David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut. We're tweeting out a link to his story about police officers who moonlight as security guards. So follow us at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in to The Record here on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. With all of the people coming to Seattle, why would you leave? We've been introducing you to folks who have decided it's time to move away. Yesterday, we met Kurt B. Riley, a.k.a. DJ El Toro on KEXP. He says it's important to leave your comfort zone.
You can take the show on the road, and it's actually good to every now and then because it forces you to reassess your own strengths and weaknesses and get in touch with who you are and who you can be in your community.
Kurt and his husband, artist and costume designer Mark Mitchell, had this parting message for Seattle.
Take care of the next generation of artists. It's too late for a lot of people in our bracket.
Seattle seems to be hemorrhaging artists now because it's so expensive to stay here and there's not studio space.
They're moving to Tucson, Arizona, where rents are half what they are here, and it is dry. A KUOW listener named Leslie relates to Kurt and Mark. She says it feels like a slow tsunami of gentrification has been moving over the city, uprooting artists and the culture we love, and leaving in its wake prefab condos and businesses that cater exclusively to the wealthy. She's leaving Seattle. So is Sandy, who writes, I no longer feel safe walking alone from a show on Cap Hill. There are far fewer quirky artist types and far more programmers. I used to love the feeling that my family of weirdos were here and making exciting stuff and thinking exciting things. Many of my weirdos are still here, but their creative opportunities are starving in the face of impossible rents. Madeline says when she came here 25 years ago, she thought she'd died and gone to heaven. People were respectful and kind. Traffic was minimal. The environment was clean and cared for. Now, she says, we suffer from crowded rat syndrome and are escaping to southern Arizona for a better life. And finally, Pam says, I'm done with the weather. It was great at first, but the winter has long lost any appeal. Thanks, Seattle. Thanks, KUOW. Thank you, Pam, and all of you who wrote. Two things come to mind. Number one, if you don't like what the Puget Sound area has become, you can leave. You can find out who else you might be, as Mark said. We'd like to hear your story. Number two, though, what about staying and improving the Puget Sound area? You can't stop the rain, but what can you do to create the region that you do want? Please tell us your story on email, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, or call us, 206-221-3663. 221-3663. Thanks for tuning in to The Record today. Catching you up on the news now, an American tug ran aground off British Columbia's coast about 2 weeks ago while it was pushing a fuel barge. The barge is okay, but the tug is still aground and leaking diesel, and it's happening just as oil pipelines are proposed to run to Canada's west coast. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, hello.
Hello, Bill. This one's getting a lot of attention for the reason you give. The concern that it's sort of an early warning of how inadequate the resources are on this coast to manage even a tugboat sinking, never mind a full-blown oil tanker.
Right. How bad is the shoreline pollution so far from the diesel?
Well, it's modest but concerning. This is a tug that regularly runs up and down the coast of British Columbia, hauling fuel barges to Alaska and coming back empty. Happily, it was on the way back, so it was empty. But it had a waiver from the Canadian authorities that allowed it to go through the congested inside passage of British Columbia without a pilot, and it ran aground at 1 o'clock in the morning 2 weeks ago. It's sitting on the bottom in about 30 feet of water. It has about 60,000 gallons of diesel on board, and there is some leaking. They put one of those containment booms around it, Bill, but there was a storm that it got loose. They've had to close the shell fishery there on the coast. They're trying to figure out, they're going to get a big crane and try to refloat the tug and get it out of there before most of the oil leaks, but it's caused a mess.
Why has it taken so long to get the tug away from the rocks and contain the fuel?
Weather. It's difficult waters in which to operate. It's a remote part of the coast. There's some evidence that the hull is partly ruptured, so they don't want to lift it off the bottom and have the tank let go and spill everything out. So it's a delicate operation, and I think they're doing the right thing there, but that's the other issue here. We're talking about twinning the big oil pipeline that comes into Vancouver from Alberta, increasing the number of tankers out of the port of Vancouver. There's a lot of oil goes out of BC waters right now on tankers, and this has dramatized the fact that we don't have anything like the resources out here we need. But the provincial government is saying, look, if we're going to twin that pipeline into Vancouver, and the national government's talking about approving it later this year, we're going to need an enormous increase in resources in BC waters. I guess the good thing about that is we clearly don't have enough resources right now to deal with something small like a tugboat. So if we got the big increase in resources, it would be safe, never mind how many additional tankers come through. Safer, I should say, not safe.
Right. The premier of BC had said that the province wasn't going to support the building of oil pipelines to the West Coast until a world-class oil spill response was in place and some other conditions were met. So that's not looking like such a good vow at this point.
Yeah, the measure of that is, I think what you would see is heavy-duty ocean-going tugs escorting every single tanker that leaves Vancouver. You would also see a great increase in the number of containment booms stored on the coast, so the resources would be here if an accident did happen. One of the reasons this thing got out of hand on the coast, the episode we're just talking about, is the nearest resources to deal with the oil spill were more than 20 hours away. There's nothing there on the coast to deal with it. So you're going to have a huge investment, probably several hundred million dollars worth of resources here on the coast before anybody's going to call it world-class means of preventing, first of all, containing, second of all, and cleaning up, third of all, oil spills on the coast.
We've been talking about this tug that's still aground and apparently leaking some diesel on the mid-coast of B.C. Good luck to the Heiltsuk Nation there and their clam beaches. I want to talk now, Vaughn, about the city of Vancouver deciding no Uber for at least a year. No ride-sharing, only taxis. Why is that?
I believe we are now the largest city in North America that does not have Uber. Uber briefly looked at entering the Vancouver market. The provincial government said it was going to bring in special regulations dealing with insurance, leveling the playing field with taxi companies. The government has not done that, and so far Uber stayed out. They've avoided a clash. The city of Vancouver is not all that keen on getting Uber in either, and in both cases, it is the enormous, to me, political clout of the taxi industry in British Columbia. It is very well organized. It helps the governments here get elected. There are a large number of drivers, of course, in the industry who've put huge amounts of money into getting their taxi licenses, hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases, and they don't want the competition. So far, British Columbia has not allowed it. We may get some regulations by the end of the year. Uber may dip its toe into the market sometime next year, but we also have an election coming, and the provincial government is still hesitant on this because, as I say, of the political power of the taxi industry.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer letting you know if you go to British Columbia, it's the taxi or the car, the bus, the bike, the walk, but no Uber for you. Vaughn, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Uber claims 200,000 British Columbians have downloaded their app and are waiting to use it. Thanks for joining us.